chapter 5, verse 1, he says, "Then I turned and raised my eyes and saw there a flying scroll. And he said to me, 'What do you see?' So I answered, 'I see a flying scroll.'" Now, that would be a book in their culture. A scroll was a book. Their books weren't binded together with pages. They were essentially long pieces of either papyrus fixed together or animal skins. And they wrote on them, both sides, and then rolled them up. So in order to, I wouldn't say turn to this page, I'd say unroll your scroll to this section. And so he's basically seeing a book in the heavens flying. A length 20 cubits, width 10 cubits. Cubit is about 18 inches, so about 30 feet by 15 feet. And is it 15 feet wide? Was it all rolled up as a scroll? Which means if you unrolled it, it would have been very, very long. Or was it just 15 feet wide? It doesn't really make sense that. But he said to me, "This is the curse that goes out over the face of the whole earth." And then he says, "Every thief shall be expelled according to this side of the scroll, and every perjurer shall be expelled according to that side of it. And I'll send out the curse, says the Lord of hosts, that shall enter the house of the thief and the house of one who swears falsely by my name, and it shall remain in the midst of the house and consume it with its timber and its stones." Now, this flying scroll, interesting. It's a picture of, really, in a way, it's not hard to get this picture simply because the dimensions, you could go back into the Old Testament and find these dimensions are really the dimensions of the holy place in the tabernacle. It would have been the same dimensions, 30 feet by 15 feet. It was the same dimensions of Solomon's temple on the porch, 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 3. The idea of it being written on both sides is also a clue that takes us back to Exodus 32, and we discover when Moses came down the mountain, he came down with how many tablets? Two tablets of stone written on both sides, according to Exodus 32, verse 15. And so in a way, this scroll essentially represents the whole law of Moses. You've got written on both sides. And interesting that there's two laws from the Ten Commandments that are brought out here. One is a thief, representing the breaking of one of the laws against people. And then a perjurer, or as he clarifies it, one who swears falsely by my name. Not just a liar, but one who actually is taking God's name in vain, misusing his name, and dishonoring him. So the swearing falsely would be breaking the middle commandment of the first tablet concerning your duties to God. The first four commandments, your duties to God. And then the last six commandments are your duties to people. And stealing is the middle commandment that would have broken that. So in a way, he has this flying book, which is representing what God requires of man. And now what it is, it is essentially a curse. Now we're told that's exactly what the law is. The law brings a curse because cursed is everyone who does not keep everything written in the law. So in a way, there is a picture of God's expectation that has not been met. And the curse that comes upon a life as a result of breaking God's laws. Now, as he says, "I will send out the curse," the time is coming when all those who are false deceivers and liars and those who take God's name in vain will see the punishment. You know, you think about it, is what is so unreasonable about what God expects of us? When you look at the Ten Commandments, can you see anything in there that's really unreasonable? If we live by those Ten Commandments, how different society would be. In fact, that is one of the biggest troubles we're facing as a nation, is that we can't write enough laws to keep people in check if they don't have the laws written on their heart. If you don't have any self-control or self-rule, there is no amount of control, there's no amount of government that could ever be afforded to try to keep everybody in check. But that's the direction we're going. If you notice, we are kind of in a panic right now in our nation. We want the government to come in and save us, as if this big, huge bureaucratic thing is going to do any less damage than Wall Street. In fact, that 20 square miles surrounded by reality there, Washington, D.C., I'm referring to, actually spends more money in a day than Wall Street lost this last year. I think it's important we put that in perspective. We can't afford the government needed if people don't have a heart to do the right thing. I mean, I was amazed at some years ago discovering that the laws just regulating the production and sale of cabbage in this country are thousands and thousands of pages, books on the laws, just on the sale and the regulation of cabbage. Why? Because if you're a cabbage farmer or a cabbage dealer or a cabbage brokerage dealer or a cabbage, you know, seller or whatever you're dealing with cabbage, you're providing, you know, stuff to put on cabbage to keep it. I mean, everybody has a scheme to get rich and to take advantage of the system. So they have to write laws and laws and laws and laws and laws to protect us from what is not in the hearts of people. So God essentially has said the time has come. The full result of this curse is going to come upon people. Now, we can't stop the coming storm from coming. But it amazes me how farther and farther people are getting away from God, even dishonoring Him. There's a guy in the UK now basically saying that if you believe in the Bible's account of creation, you're part of the reason why this world is being destroyed, because you believe that God made the world for people. And of course, you know, everybody knows that we're just expendable. The planet is the most important thing. And, you know, it's just the worldview that is becoming more and more prominent. It was interesting to me reading about this guy that is doing this program in the UK. His name escapes me right now, but he's a big proponent on public television over there for Darwinism, and believes that if everyone were Darwinists, the world would be a much better place. I think he's very ignorant of that, but that's my opinion. At the same time, he said something interesting. He was actually being sanctimonious and as he was marginalizing Christians when he said that, you know, he gets letters from Christians who say, well, God made the flowers and the trees and there's such wonderful design in the world. It's obvious that there's a God. And then he says, well, did he also make the parasite that bores into the eyeball of the little child in Africa? You know, what kind of a God does that? Now, how many of you ever heard a question like that, and how do you respond? How do you respond to something that actually implicates God or essentially comes to a conclusion there is no God? Because obviously God wouldn't do that, so it just everything came by chance. And I thought, you know, the interesting thing is God gave us the dominion over this world to take care of it. And it seems strange to me that right now, which is all the rage in the protection of the environment, becoming more green, reducing your carbon footprint, which means that we pressure third world countries to not get coal and use fuel, natural fuels, because that will ruin the environment. And so we're keeping them in a very difficult spot. They can't refrigerate their food. They can't sterilize things. So they're much more subject to parasites. In fact, when we outlawed DDT, DDT saved millions of lives from malaria, and every year millions die in Africa because of malaria, which could have easily been eradicated. But it was after Europe and America eradicated malaria, then conveniently it seemed we outlawed DDT. What I'm saying to you is that people will bring an argument like this parasite, but not fully tell you, well, look, it's those who have a heart to help who could actually get over there and help these people have more sanitary lives, which would prevent them from being subject to these parasites. The idea is that God has given it to us to either care for our brother or not, and just care for ourselves. And I think more and more we're becoming a nation that is just thinking in terms of the person is expendable for the greater picture, when in reality, God cares for each individual, and that's the heart that He's given to His people. But this is the whole point. God is going to deal with people. And this flying scroll to me is a picture, which essentially the picture here too is it will remain in that house. That is, it's going to literally, the term in Hebrew, it's kind of interesting, it'll spend the night. And the idea there, it's not going to just spend one night, but it's going to be permanently with you. You can't get away from it. And this is really what's happening. You know, I think of so many things in this nation that if it weren't for the corruption in the heart of man, how different our nation would be. I mean, these Ponzi schemes that people have perpetrated, taking off with $50 billion, this Madoff character. and people buying into it, getting rich quick, thinking if they're investing in something real and all they're doing is getting paid back by other people's money, and eventually the pyramid crashes. So God is going to deal with it. And I believe this vision is a picture of the coming judgment. But also, there's another vision. The second vision, found in verse 5. He says, "Then the angel who talked with me came out and said to me, 'Lift your eyes now and see what this is that goes forth.'" So I asked, "What is it?" And he said, "It's a basket that is going forth," or ephah. In that language, in the Hebrew language, that would be their largest measurement, which was just slightly bigger than a bushel. He says, "And this is their resemblance throughout the earth. Here is a lead disc lifted up, and this is a woman sitting inside the basket." And he said, "This is wickedness." So we've got this really strange thing. You see a basket, then you see a woman sitting inside the basket, and we're told that this is wickedness. So wickedness is personified in the feminine here. "And he thrust her down into the basket and threw the lead cover over its mouth." So the idea is now wickedness is contained and caged, if you will. "And I raised my eyes and looked, and there were two women coming out with the wind in their wings, for they had wings like the wings of a stork. And they lifted up the basket between earth and heaven. So I said to the angel who talked to me, 'Where are they carrying the basket?' And he said to me," now essentially, where's wickedness going? "And he said to me, 'To build a house for it in the land of Shinar. When it is ready, the basket will be set there on its base.'" Now, they have just come back from captivity from Babylon. So there is not a picture here. Babylon has already shown its evil and now has been pretty much put off the throne. The Medo-Persian Empire has pretty much dealt with Babylon. There's going to be some more skirmishes between Egypt and Babylon that the Persians will have, but pretty much they put them under. And so this is not relating to his day, because this is something that is going to obviously happen in the future. When we see the full picture, we realize this is going to be far future, and it's kind of an indication that from the Bible tells us, when we read in, all the way through in Genesis, the very first place that was prominently in antagonistic speech against God was Nimrod and in the land of Shinar, which is Babylonia. That's where he established his Tower of Babel, in rebellion against God. Where rebellion really took foot in the world, which of course even the Garden of Eden was in the very seat there, in modern day Iraq and Iran. You could actually see the very root of rebellion there in man through Babylon. And eventually what's going to happen is the wickedness is going to be sealed up and it's going to be taken there, and the center of wickedness will be there. There are those that believe that Babylon is the symbolic aspect of evil and wickedness in the world. People have called America kind of a biblical Babylon. The problem I have with that is that every time I read in the Bible, when it speaks about nations and prophecies, the Bible is pretty specific. And when it mentions about Egypt or mentions about Babylon, it's not speaking symbolically unless it tells you it's speaking symbolically. And sometimes it even says, like, Israel symbolically was Babylon and Rome was symbolically Babylon. And it even says that at certain points. But it appears now that this wickedness cage now is going to be set up, literally set up, build a house or a pedestal. It's going to be honored, it's going to be exalted once again in Babylon. And of course, when you look at Revelation, you realize how that's going to all come to be. So here's a picture. This woman, covered with this lead disc, now transported to the land of Shinar. This wickedness is now going to have an exaltation there. And so it's just, it kind of makes you think, okay, the Lord's going to judge the whole world. The scroll is going to basically now, it's going to bring a curse upon everyone who has not done all those things written in it. Now, you haven't done all those things written in it, but a curse has been removed from you if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, because he paid that curse. He paid for it with his own blood on the cross. Secondly, when it comes to this plan in the end time in the land of Shinar, this, I believe, is correlating to the time in Revelation 17 and 18. But now you come to chapter 6, and he says, "Then I turned and raised my eyes and looked, and behold, four chariots were coming from between two mountains, and the mountains were mountains of bronze. With the first chariot were red horses and the second chariot black horses. Now, when you look at the visions, you can actually make a correlation between these visions. And you have four horses in the first, and now you've got in the last one four horses with chariots. And there is a relationship between them. But you find there's a difference here. In the one, there's one mountain, and here there's two mountains. And you go, well, what is he referring to, two mountains of bronze? Obviously, the idea of bronze is that of hardness, impenetrableness, and some even feel judgment, where he is going to come and judge. Some have speculated that these mountains could very easily be the one mountain, which was the Mount of Olives, which when Jesus comes down, according to Zechariah later, he stands on it. It's going to divide east to west. There's going to be a valley, so you're going to have two mountains. Could be referring to that. Okay, well, let's get back to this. We got to catch up with this four chariots. He says, with the first chariot were red horses, the second chariot black horses, and the third chariot white horses, and the fourth chariot dappled horses. In the first glance, in the first vision, when we saw those four horses, we wanted to make a connection to the four horses of the apocalypse and Revelation that just didn't seem to match up with the colors and what they were for. Revelation, it tells you specifically what they represent, so you don't have to guess. And the same thing here, you've got a difference here, and it doesn't seem to correlate perfectly. But then you don't have to worry about that, because he will tell you a little bit more what these horses are. He says, then I answered and said to the angel who talked to me, what are these, my Lord? And the angel answered and said to me, these are four spirits of heaven, or the four winds of heaven. Wind and spirit in the English is usually translated from the one word in the Greek and in Hebrew. In the Greek, it's pneuma, which is translated wind, and also translated breath or spirit. And in the Hebrew, ruach, which is translated wind or breath or spirit. And so it's the idea of just the wind, you know, the spirit. You can't see, but we're told these are four spirits. These are four angelic beings, apparently, of heaven, who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth. The one with the black horse is going to the north country, the white going after them, and the dappled are going to the south country. So the black horse, which, you know, is going first, then the white horse following is different from Revelation. The white horse kind of is the depiction of conqueror, if you follow what the clear picture in Revelation is. Black is the picture of famine. And it's almost interesting to look at that if you follow that same line. In the north, famine is first, then they're conquered. And that's not an unusual way to conquer a nation. In fact, oftentimes tyrannical regimes will starve their people to control them. We see that in Somalia. We saw that in other places of the world, and it's tragic. And you send food and money over there to help, and basically it just supports the regime to keep the people under control because they buy weapons with it, and it's a very, very difficult situation. So there's obviously this is a little bit different here, this going to the north and going to the south. And, well, let's keep going because we still don't have a clue here. Then the strong steeds went out eager to go that they might walk to and fro throughout the earth. Now, I remember when they walked to and fro throughout the earth as the watchers kind of a way. But here he says they walked to and fro throughout the earth. So they walked to and fro throughout the earth. And he called me and spoke to me saying, see, those who go toward the north country have given rest to my spirit in the north country. So all of this leads up to this idea where these spirits have gone forth and they brought rest in the north. Now, all through Israel's history, trouble comes from the north. We talk about the Gog and Magog war. That will come from the north. Where they were attacked from Babylon came from the north. Most of their troubles came from the north. Periodically from the south, with Egypt, but most of the time from the north. And the idea here is that, you know, these spirits traveling to the north have pacified his wrath there. And apparently they're agents sent by God acting as watchers or hedging in the satanic plan so that all the schemes of the enemy. See, I look at how God works throughout the world. It seems like he gives wickedness a lot of free rein, doesn't it? But, you know, it kind of reminds me of when I used to play chess. I don't have time anymore. But I always like to lure my opponent in by kind of leaving my left flank open, kind of looking quite vulnerable. And then, you know, if they were halfway decent chess players, they would buy it. But I could get some of the lesser good chess players to, oh, I'm going to go down that road. And so I'd pull them in, and then I'd trap them. I'd just hedge them in. And I think in many ways, the Lord in His wisdom, when we look at the world, it looks in chaos. What's going on? This is out of control. My life, the nation, you know, what's happening, my future. I mean, we look at life that way. And it's sad that we do, because as Christians, we're called to walk by faith and not by sight. Because we have got to see that no matter what happens, no matter how much free reign it appears Satan has. Remember Job. God gave the devil permission to touch Job. But God hedged him to a point where he only allowed him to go so far and then ultimately brought about good for Job. That if you were to interview Job right now, a lot of you might go, well, I don't know, it seemed pretty hard, that's a lot to take, I don't believe that, I don't understand that. Well, all you have to do is interview Job now. Hey, Job, was it worth it? And he'll tell you it was worth it, so end of discussion. I mean, when you see the end, you're going to realize, wow, God was faithful. He showed himself faithful. And that all that I thought was going downhill, I don't regret any of the pain and the struggle and the problems that I had before I yielded to the Lord, even after when I yielded to the Lord, when it didn't seem to be going my way. And believe me, as a young believer, I strived with my Maker. You know, I was wrestling with Him. Why are you allowing this in my life? So, I mean, I'll be honest. This whole idea of the North and the black horses going to the North and the South and all this stuff, I really don't understand the details of this. There are many commentators that differ on these exact meanings, but at the end of the day, I can kind of see the end result is that they're agents of God in some way, somehow, working with the powers and the forces that are there in the world to hedge their plan. Even though, like even in the end times, when it looks like Satan is winning, the Antichrist is going to get on the throne and rule the world, right? Well, it's a very temporary rule, folks. And we have to see sometimes the pain and the struggle in our own life as a very temporary situation that God is using to bring about a greater good. If, listen, this is a big if we don't grow weary and stop trusting Him. This kind of measures us out. Will we trust Him is the big question. Am I going to trust Him through it? Do I need to understand everything He's doing before I'll trust Him? Hey, your kids don't play by that rule. You know that. You know that you're not going to give them, or they might not even have the capacity to understand why they shouldn't play in the street, you know, when it looks fun to them. And you try to explain it to them, and they still don't understand, and they want to know why, and you say, because that's all you can get across to them at that point. And sometimes that's all the Lord says. We say, why? And He goes, because. Well, that's not an answer. Precisely. We couldn't comprehend the full picture, but we have to trust Him. So all the schemes and strategizing of the enemy eventually gets channeled into God's ultimate plan, which is unstoppable. Babylon in the end will be finally judged never to rise, according to the Bible. Now, this is very problematic because if the Bible says Babylon will be judged and never rise, when you look at it, it was judged, but it still rose and it still had prominence. Even today, as there are those that have actually rebuilt part of it, some have speculated that could very well be. I know it's just the flight of fancy for some to consider that that could be the center of world government one day. If the power shift keeps going to the east with oil and the prominence and the west declines, very possible. Right now in our vantage point, maybe we don't think it, but all I know is that I believe literally what the Bible says. Somehow or another, He's going to work these things out. So the eight visions have concluded. Eight visions that kind of depict the Lord's work within the world. And now we come to verse 9, kind of a sum up, and this will lead us into a greater picture of the Lord and how He works. The word of the Lord came to me saying, receive the gift from the captives. Now apparently he's awoke from his daydream, which it was a vision during the day. And he says, from Heldel, from Tobijah, from Jedidiah, who have come from Babylon, and go the same day, which presumably it's the same day that he had this vision, and enter the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah. He says, take the silver and gold, that is the gifts that they've brought from Babylon. Now, these are captives that have come. See, there's always a trickle of captives coming from Babylon back to jump in and work, build a temple, kind of get back focused on the things of God. So these people have come, and he says, take the silver and gold and make an elaborate crown and set it on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Most would not see the significance of this because you might not be aware that a high priest would never wear a royal crown. That would be for a ruler, that would be for a king. And the kings and the priests were kept separate. Do you know that's why our founding fathers actually, they copied this style from the Bible when they thought about our nation? They wanted to keep a separation between the civil authorities and the church. There is separation of church and state in that sense. When you look at history, and it's interesting to follow this out, when you look at history, the times when the state essentially dominated and ruled over the church was a very painful time, but it was also equally painful when the church took civil power and control. We call it the Dark Ages, when they ruled and ran things. So you have the church ruling the world, and essentially that's what Islamic law would do. Sharia essentially is not a matter of religious law. It's a matter of, it's a civil law that you follow if you're going to follow this Islamic state. Once Sharia law is enacted, essentially it's kind of like pretty dominant, because if you convert from Islam, then you'll be killed. So pretty much everyone's going to be Islam or you're in trouble. Now, here's the interesting thing. There's a problem here. This crown on the head of a priest is very strange. Remember Uzziah, who went into the temple when he started offering up incense, 2 Chronicles 26? And the priest stood in his face and said, get out of here, you've got no authority in here. I think it's always a good thing when godly people can stand up knowing what God has said and know, I will obey government unless they tell me to do something that goes against the Bible. Then I'm going to say, see ya. Not going to happen. And that's where civil disobedience would come in. And really, that's exactly what this priest did. He stood right in the front of the king and said, get out of here. You know, you have no authority to be in here. And the king was angry. And when he got angry, all of a sudden leprosy broke out all over his body. And then he went out. He was eager to get out then. And he remained a leper until he died. He was a very loved king, but he went too far. And of course, that's the one problem. The other problem, again, is when the church tries to control and run the state. God kept them separate. The leaders were to come from the tribe of Judah, and the priests were to come from the tribe of Levi. You could not be a king unless you had Judah's lineage, and you couldn't be a priest unless you had Levi's genes. So, you know, that's how it worked. You were separate. They were never together. All right, so now, having that understanding, this is weird, right? He's building this crown, an elaborate crown, and he says, put it on the high priest. And they said to him, thus says the Lord of hosts, saying, behold the man. Now, I just have to stop you for a moment. Does that sound familiar at all? I don't think it's by accident that John, in his gospel account, records Pilate bringing Jesus out before the people after he was scourged and the crown of thorns on his head. And he said, behold the man. Echo homo in the Greek. Behold the man. And interestingly enough, here you have the Lord saying, behold the man whose name is what? The branch. Now that's already been established. This is the Messiah. He shall be called a Nazarene, which is the same root word of branch. So the Lord is making a very plain picture here that what happened to Joshua by putting the crown on his head was a type, a prefigure for the Messiah. So you would recognize him. He would have both offices of priest and king. Now, Jesus had authority genetically to be king because he was of the tribe of Judah. He's a line of the tribe of Judah. But he was not a Levitical connection. How could he be priest? Hebrews answers that by telling us that he was a priest according to a greater order that predates Levi back to Abraham. And Abraham gave tithes to Melchizedek. And in a way, Abraham, who was greater than Levi, was acknowledging Melchizedek as greater. So Jesus is a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, I know I'm losing some of you here, and some of this is a little technical, but it's important to realize that what's being said here. He says, from his place he shall branch out, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. So another picture here, he's going to build the temple of the Lord. Now, there's two things about that. Remember Jesus said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll build it up again, or I'll raise it up again? What was he referring to? His body. And then, of course, he says, as I'm in the world, so I'm sending you. And later we discover in the epistles that those who believed in Jesus, the Spirit of God has come into you, and now you are the temple of the Holy Spirit. You are the temple of God. You are the habitation of God. So he has built his temple, but listen, remember, all of this is just the down payment. Don't just stop there, because then you'll find yourself stuck. You'll begin to think that, well, then God is finished with the actual physical Jerusalem and physical people of Israel. And that's not the case. They've only been hardened for a time. We've just been grafted in. But God is going to one day again come back and reign. And so he shall build the temple of the Lord and shall bear his glory. There is two aspects to that. Of course, on the cross, he was glorified, because what he did by dying for us, he was exalted above every other name. And he truly built the temple of the Lord. But then he goes on to say, and you shall sit and rule on his throne, and he'll be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. What both? Between the priesthood and the rulership, the kings. Between the kings and the priests, there's going to be a council of peace, because they're going to be one. Now it says, if you, by paying close attention, he's going to sit and rule on his throne. I believe that from the spiritual side, he is sitting right now, according to the Bible, on his Father's throne. He's sitting at the right hand of his Father. That's very easy to see when you can follow these passages. He sat down at the right hand of God in Hebrews 10, verse 12. He sat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. He sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, Hebrews 1, 3. In fact, Revelation 3:21 says it very plainly. He says, to him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne. On my throne. On my throne, Jesus said. But listen, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. So there's Jesus' throne and the Father's throne. Why is that important? Because listen, this answers the dilemma. For the Reformed theologian who believes that God is finished with Israel, for those, they hate dispensationalism because they think that it creates two groups of people, Israel and the church, and really there shouldn't be two groups in their mind. But understand, from a spiritual side, Jesus is sitting on his Father's throne right now. And he's reigning from there, if you will, in a spiritual way. I mean, we have peace in our hearts as a result of his reign on our lives. But listen, this is just the down payment. He's going to come back. When he comes back, then he's going to sit down on his throne. You understand? And he shall reign forever and ever. And we're told that he is a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. He's going to come and sit and rule on his throne, but he's also the priest. So Jesus came in the role of a prophet, died on the cross, offering the sacrifice of his own blood in the role of a priest, and one day will come back and be both king and priest forever. And we wait for that. Now, he goes on to say this in verse 14. Now the elaborate crown shall be for a memorial in the temple of the Lord for Halem, Tobijath, Jedidiah, and Hen, the son of Zephaniah. Even those from afar shall come and build the temple of the Lord. Then you shall know. So he tells us about the crown. It's a memorial. In other words, put it on his head, then take it off and put it in the temple. Because this was just a prefigure. Joshua is not going to be king from this point on, even though they put the crown on his head. It was taken off and put into the temple. It was just temporary. It was a memorial. But then he goes on to say, coming back to that time, see, he's spoken of this glorious future. But now he says, okay, take the crown off, put it in the temple. It's a memorial. We're not ready for that yet. That time will come. You'll look forward to that. In the meantime, now he gives the temporary promise here, which I think is interesting. He says, even those from afar shall come and build the temple of the Lord. Then you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. And this shall come to pass if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God. So the Lord has given us amazing promise. How do you test all of these things? Well, you look at the short-term prophecy that you can test his words. Just like if I were to give you a prophecy of something that would happen 1,000 years from now, no way you could test that. How do you know I'm telling the truth? If I also tell you something that's going to happen short-term, and when that comes to pass exactly, then you can trust the long-term prophecy. That's why I think it's exciting. When you read the Bible, see how God has fulfilled his word. You should have no problem trusting he is going to do everything that he said he would do in it. That flying scroll, his word will not be broken. But it should be just a testimony for us to come and discover this priest king, this one who died for us. The sad thing is, right now, in the church, what has crept in is what's called the new spirituality. And so many people being deceived by doctrines that have crept in unaware in the church. And under the guise of words like new spirituality, you might have heard terms like that. They're really old terms, borrowed terms, because the new spirituality is really the new age. And the idea that God is all-pervading. Even in popular books like The Shack, there's that subtle message behind it. It was a wonderfully moving book of forgiveness and the depth of coming to surrender to the Lord. I mean, it had great movement in it. But the subtle message there was that God is in all things. And, you know, it's almost a pantheistic type of a thing. And he can appear as whatever. And, you know, the idea of the real focus on our lives is that we need to discover the greatness within us. This is that new age mentality. It's creeping in. And you know what's happening more and more? They're even marginalizing the cross. When you watch Oprah, hopefully you don't watch her too much. Because the problem with her, I mean, she does a lot of wonderful things. I'm not attacking her, you know, social work and all those other things, but her theology is horrendous. She's promoting the Course in Miracles and a few other things that are really deceiving Christians into this new spirituality, where essentially what they say in the Course of Miracles, it's very plain, basically it marginalizes the cross. You don't need the old rugged cross. You don't need the blood of the sacrifice anymore. We're way past that. That's passé. We come into this new understanding now. The Robert Schruler kind of, you know, like you can be your own God almost. He's bought in, he's promoted a lot of these new age theologians. Point is this. Everything in the Bible leads to the priesthood of what Jesus did on the cross, that he offered the sacrifice, and the sacrifice was his own blood. Tonight, when we partake of communion, we're essentially doing what Jesus said. He says, do this as often as you do in remembrance of me. As often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you're proclaiming what? What is the most important thing you're proclaiming by doing this? His death. That which the new spirituality wants you to marginalize. His death. That's what we rejoice in. We call it Good Friday. Not Good Sunday. Wait a minute, Sunday he resurrected. Shouldn't that have been called good and called Bad Friday? Good Sunday? No, it was Good Friday. Why is it Good Friday? Because of the cross. The priest performed his duty perfectly. Once and for all. No more need for a priest anymore and to go between you and God. Don't call me a priest. But if you do, think about it this. Every believer, in a sense, is a priest and king unto the Father. You all have been given a ministry of reconciliation. God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. And you know what? When you go out into the world and you're his ambassador, he's in you, using you to reconcile the world to himself. As Jesus ministered, so he sends us. And this wonderful picture is, but we all come back to the cross. It's his death. It's from his death that we have access. Once you have access, now you can come boldly to the throne of grace. A wonderful, wonderful truth in the scriptures. So important to understand these things. But finally, he makes this kind of interesting warning in the end. He says, "And this shall come to pass if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God." You know, it's interesting that the obedience will come from the belief. They wouldn't obey unless they believed. You don't obey God unless you truly trust Him. Really, you're not going to obey unless you do trust. And people who, listen, when you see Christians disobeying, it's really because they're not trusting Him at that point in their life. They're thinking they've got to take matters in their own hands. They've got to do their own thing. And I think when we come back to the cross, what we come back to is realization of surrender to what He did for you. Not looking inwardly and trying to come up with your own internal greatness and ability and strength, because it's not there. I always love what Corrie Ten Boom said, and wonderful, wonderful woman of God who survived the Holocaust, having saved and rescued many Jewish people because they were true Christians in their country. They got caught and they got thrown into the same predicament as the Jews that were being killed in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany. And she has just a wonderful saying. She says, "Look around you and be distressed. Look within you and be depressed. Look to Jesus and be at rest." And I love that picture. And I hope that tonight you can have that same picture. And when you're partaking of communion, all of the turmoil that you might have from the outside, everything that's happening to you, and maybe your stock portfolio and the prospect of future and what's going on with this economy and what my job situation is, it's distressing looking out there. And then worse yet, you start looking inside. You know, what you have and your failures and your weaknesses, and you haven't been able to do this or that, and you've let God down how many times? You're going to be depressed. But hopefully one thing will get our eyes in what Jesus wanted us to do. Do this in remembrance of me. Look to what I did for you.